briefly from side to side.
"These are the claims of a desperate woman. This is beneath you, my dear."
"They're listening," Margot thought. "Perhaps they can still be convinced."
"Of course,"
the voice of Pendergast intruded on her thoughts.
"Kawakita fell into this ceremony, this dispensing of the drug, because it seemed the easiest way to keep his own poor victims docile. But he didn't especially enjoy the trappings or the ritual. He didn't take them seriously. That was your addition. As an anthropologist, how you must have enjoyed the chance to create your own cult. Minions, or perhaps acolytes, wielding primitive knives, your own hut of skulls, a reliquary for your wheelchair, symbol of your own transformation."
Frock stood stiffly, saying nothing.
"That's the real reason the killings have been increasing. It's not lack of the drug anymore, is it? Now you've got a reservoir full. No, there's another agenda, an obsessive one, an architectural one."
He nodded toward the hut.
"You needed a temple for your new religion, for your personal deification."
Frock looked at Pendergast, his lips twitching.
"And why not? Every new age needs its new religion, but it's still a ceremony at its core, isn't it? And everything relies on control. If these creatures know the effects are irreversible, what hold will you have on them?"
Murmurs were rising from among the closest wrinklers.
"Enough!"
Frock cried, clapping his hands.
"We don't have much time. Prepare them!"
Margot felt her arms seized again. Then she was dragged to her feet, a knife point placed against her throat. Frock looked at her, a strange mix of expressions again playing across his face.
"I wish you could be here to experience the change for yourself, Margot. But many must fall in the transition. I am sorry."
Smithback lunged towards Frock, but was dragged back.
"Dr. Frock!" Pendergast cried. "Margot was your student. Remember how the three of us struggled against the museum beast? Even now, you're not wholly responsible for what's happened. Perhaps there is still a way for you to go back. We'll heal your mind." "And destroy my life?"
Frock leaned toward the FBI agent, lowering his voice to whisper.
"Go back to what, may I ask? Being a helpless, superannuated, slightly ridiculous curator emeritus? One whose years are rapidly dwindling? Surely Margot's research showed you there is another side effect to the new drug. It eliminates the concentration of free radical molecules in living tissue. In short, it extends life. You would have me give up both my freedom of movement and my life?"
He looked at his watch.
12:20. We're out of time."
There was a sudden puff of wind, and a series of small dust clouds arose from the skulls forming the top rank of the hut. Almost immediately, there was a sharp rattling noise, and Margot realized she was hearing the sound of automatic weapons fire. There was a strange popping sound, then another, and suddenly the entire pavilion exploded in a burst of brilliant light. Screams and squeals of pain sounded from all sides. There was another burst, and the knife point vanished from her neck. Margot shook her head, stunned, temporarily blinded by the fierce glare. The chanting died away into confusion, and Margot heard angry howls arise from the group. While her eyes were closed, there was yet another burst of light, accompanied by more screams of pain. Margot felt one of the wrinklers drop his hold. With the instinctive speed of desperation, she twisted out of the grasp of her other captor and lunged toward the ground, rolling away, scrambling onto her hands and knees, blinking desperately in an effort to restore her sight. As the spots of black and white began to clear, she could see several plumes of smoke rising from the floor, burning impossibly bright. Wrinklers everywhere had fallen to the ground, pawing at their faces, hiding their heads beneath their cloaks, convulsing with pain. Nearby, Pendergast and Agosta had also broken free and were rushing to the aid of Smithback. Suddenly, there was a loud explosion, and one side of the hut collapsed in a gout of flame. A shrapnel cloud of shattered bone flew across the closest ranks.
"Some of the SEALs must still be alive!"
Pendergast shouted, pulling Smithback toward them.
"That shooting is coming from the platform outside the pavilion. Let's head for it while we still can. Where's Mephisto?" "Stop them!"
Frock boomed, shading his own eyes, but the blinded wrinklers milled about in confusion. Just then, another shell landed in the clearing before the hut, bursting the paling into countless pieces and shattering two of the cauldrons.
A great gush of steaming liquid began pouring across the floor, gleaming in the torchlight. Cries of dismay rose from the wrinklers, and several of those on the ground nearby began to lap up the precious fluid. Frock was shouting, gesturing in the direction the shells had come. The Ghoster and the others ran toward the free ground at the rear of the hut. Margot hesitated, looking around desperately for her carryall.
The intense light was dropping, and a few of the creatures were beginning to shamble toward them now, hands up against the glare, stone knives glinting evilly.
"Dr. Green, now!" Pendergast cried.
Suddenly she saw it, lying torn and open on the dusty ground. She grabbed for it, then sprinted after Smithback. The group had halted near the tunnel leading toward the platform, their exit blocked by a ragged line of wrinklers.
"Shit!" the Ghoster muttered fervently.
"Hey!"
Margot heard the unmistakable voice of Mephisto shouting above the noise and confusion.
"Fat Napoleon!"
She turned to see Mephisto scrambling onto one of the empty platforms, turquoise necklace swinging wildly around his neck. There was another blast, farther away this time. A gout of flame arose from the midst of one of the scattered processions. Frock turned in his direction, squinting.
"Drug-addled bum, am I? Take a look!"
Mephisto dug deep into the crotch of his filthy pants and drew out what looked to Margot like a kidney-shaped disc of green plastic.
"You know what this is? Anti-personnel mine! Chock full of metal splinters coated in Teflon, propelled by a charge equal to 20 grenades. Very ugly!"
Mephisto shook it in Frock's direction.
"It's armed, so tell your leathery minions to back off!"
The wrinklers paused.
"A bluff!" Frock said calmly. "You may be filth, but you're not a suicide."
"Are you so sure?"
Mephisto grinned.
"Tell you what, I'd rather be blown to pieces than end up decorating that little A-frame of yours."
He nodded toward Pendergast.
"Yo! Grant's tomb! You'll forgive me, I hope, for appropriating this tidbit from your armory. Promises are all very nice, but I plan to make sure nobody ever rousted Route 666 again. Now, you'd best hie yourself over here if we're going to get topside."
Pendergast shook his head and tapped his wrist, signifying they'd run out of time. Frock gestured frantically to the hooded figures surrounding the platforms.
"Cut his throat!"
he cried. The wrinklers swarmed toward Mephisto, who pulled himself up to the center of the platform.
"Goodbye, Mayor Whitey," he called. "Remember your promise!"
Margot turned away in horror as he tossed the disc into the masses surging around his feet. There was a sudden orange flash, the dank, filthy space filled with the heat of the sun, then the overwave of pressure hit, a massive blast that threw her to the ground. Rising to her knees, she looked back to see a great sheet of flame roar up behind the ruined hut, red against the brilliant white of the flares. For a moment, she could see the silhouette of Frock, standing as if triumphant, his arms outstretched, his white hair tinted orange by a thousand tongues of fire, before all was engulfed in roiling smoke and flames. In the confusion, the ragged group of wrinklers before them was parting.
"Move!"
Pendergast cried over the roar of the firestorm. Hoisting her pack, Margot followed them under the archway at the far end of the crystal pavilion. On the railway platform beyond, she could see DeGosta and Smithback come to a halt beside a slightly built man in a black wetsuit, his face slick with sweat and camouflage paint. There were wet wheezing sounds behind her. The wrinklers had closed ranks and were bearing down on them. At the narrow mouth of the archway, Margot stopped and turned.
"Margot!"
Pendergast shouted from the platform.
"What are you doing?"
"We've got to stop them here,"
Margot cried, digging into her pack.
"We'll never outrun them. Don't be a fool,"
Pendergast said. Ignoring him, Margot grabbed two of the liter bottles, one in each hand. Gripping them tightly, she hosed a stream of liquid across the archway entrance.
"Stop!"
she cried.
"I've got 2 billion units of vitamin D3 in this bottle."
The wrinklers came on, their eyes blood red and streaming, their skin mottled and burned from the intense light. She shook the squeeze bottles.
"Hear me, you! Activated 7D hydrocholesterol, enough to kill all of you 10 times over!"
As the first wrinkler reached her, knife raised, she hosed it in the face and then hit a second wrinkler just behind it. They fell backward, writhing horribly, small wisps of acrid smoke rising from their skin. The other wrinklers paused, a gibbering sound rising from their ranks.
"Vitamin D!" Margot repeated. "Bottle sunlight!"
She raised her arms and sent 2 delicate streams of liquid arcing over the milling crowd. A wail rose up, some falling and tearing at their cloaks, splattering droplets on their companions. Margot stepped forward and hosed the rest of the front rank.
They fell backward in sheer panic, the sounds of gibbering and wailing filling the air. She advanced again, spraying a thick line of solution from left to right, and then the mass of wrinklers broke and turned, scrambling over one another to get away, leaving a dozen convulsing, smoking bodies on the floor, ripping desperately at their cloaks. Margot stepped back and hosed the rest of the solution across the floor of the archway, then up along its sides and ceiling, leaving the exit tunnel wet and dripping. She tossed the empty containers into the pavilion.
Let's go!
She ran after the others, catching up to them by an open grating at the far end of the platform.
We've got to get back to the rally point, the black-suited figure said. Those charges are set to go off in 10 minutes.
You first, Margot, the ghost said.
As she dropped to the level of the tracks and began to descend into the drain below, a series of shattering explosions sounded behind and above her.
Our charges! The ghost cried. The fires must have set them off prematurely!
Pendergast turned to answer, but his voice was drowned in a rumble which, like an earthquake, was felt first in the feet, then in the gut, growing in violence and volume. A strange wind kicked up in the passageway, a gathering roar of air forced along by the collapse of the crystal pavilion, pushing dust, smoke, scraps of paper, and the ripe smell of blood before it. 62. Margot dropped through the drain into a long, low tunnel, lit only by the sputtering glow of a dying flare. Several piles of rubble were strewn here and there, poking up from the standing water on the tunnel floor. Above her, the passages still rumbled and shook from the after-effects of the concussion. Dust and debris drifted down through the drain, settling onto her shoulders. Smithback fell into the water beside her, followed by Pendergast, DaGosta, and the diver.
"Who the hell are you?" DaGosta asked. "And what happened to the rest of the seals?"
"I'm not a seal, sir," the man said. "I'm a police diver. Officer Snow, sir."
"Well, well," said DaGosta. "The guy who started it all. Got a light, Snow?"
The diver snapped a new flare to life, and suddenly the tunnel was illuminated by a harsh crimson glare.
"Oh, God!"
Margot heard Smithback murmur beside her. Then she realized that what she thought to be piles of rubble were actually rubber-suited divers, battered and headless, their bodies splayed in mute agony. The surrounding walls were pocked and scarred by countless bullet holes and the charred tracings of shells.
"Seal Team Gamma," Snow muttered. "After my partner bought it, I ran back here to make a stand. Those creatures chased me up the drain, but then abandoned the chase on those tracks up there."
"Guess they were late for the debutante's ball," DaGosta said, looking around at the massacre site, his face hard.
"You didn't see any of the other seals in there, sir?" Snow asked. "I followed the prints. I hoped some of them might have survived."
His voice trailed off when he saw the look on DaGosta's face. There was a moment of awkward silence.
"Come on," Snow urged, once again animated. "There's still 40 pounds of C4 around here waiting to go off."
Margot stumbled forward in a dark daze. She felt the floor of the tunnel solid beneath her feet, and she tried to draw that solidity up through her feet, her legs, and her arms. She knew she could not allow herself to think about what she had seen, what she had learned, inside the crystal pavilion. If she stopped to do that, she would be unable to go on. The tunnel took a long, shallow bend. Ahead, Margot could see Snow and DaGosta already moving into a large, vaulted space at the end of the tunnel. Beside her, she could hear Smithback's breathing turn choppy. Her eyes drifted toward the tunnel floor. Around her lay the torn and bloodied bodies of perhaps a dozen wrinklers. She caught a glimpse of a dirty hood, burned away to expose skin, seamed and veined to an extraordinary thickness.
"Striking," Pendergast murmured at her side. "The reptilian traits are unmistakable, yet the human attributes remain dominant. An early way station, so to speak, on the way to the full-blown Mbwanhood. Odd, though, how the metamorphosis is so much greater in certain specimens than in others. No doubt due to Kawakita's continual refinements and experimentations. Shame there's no time for further study."
The echoes of their footfalls grew broader as they moved into the large space at the end of the tunnel. There were several more still forms lying scattered in the shallow water.
"This is our rally point," Snow said, as he sorted quickly through the rows of equipment lining one side of the vaulted space.
Margot could hear the sharp edge of nervousness in his voice.
"There's more than enough scuba equipment here to get us out, but no suits. Look, we've got to move quickly. If we're still here when those charges blow, this whole place is going to come down on top of us."
Pendergast handed her a set of tanks.
Dr. Green, we have you to thank for our escape, he said. You were right about the vitamin D, and you were able to contain the creatures within the pavilion until the explosions blocked their escape. I promise you'll be welcome on any further excursions we may make. Margot nodded as she snugged her feet into a pair of flippers.
Thanks, but once was enough.
The FBI agent turned toward Snow. What's the exit strategy?
We came in through the sewage treatment plant on the Hudson, Snow replied, shouldering his air tank and strapping on a headlamp. But there's no way to return through the plant. We were to leave via the north branch of the West Side Lateral to the 125th Street Canal.
Can you get us there? Pendergast asked, quickly passing air tanks to Smithback and helping to fit them.
I think so, Snow panted, pulling masks out of the equipment pile.
I had a good long look at the commander's maps. We retrace our route as far as the first flow riser. If we ascend the riser instead of descend, we should reach the access spillway leading out into the lateral. But it's a long swim and we'll have to be extremely careful. There are sluice gates and evacuation shunts. Get lost down those and...
His voice petered off.
Understood, Pendergast said, shrugging into a set of air tanks. Mr. Smithback, Dr. Green, ever used scuba gear before?
Took a few lessons in college, Smithback said, accepting the proffered mask.
Skin dived in the Bahamas, Margot said.
The principle's the same, Pendergast said to her. We'll adjust your regulator. Just breathe normally, stay calm, and you'll do fine.
Hurry! Snow said, real urgency in his voice now. He began to jog toward the far end of the vaulted space, Smithback and Pendergast close behind him. Margot forced herself to follow, tightening her tank belt as she ran. Suddenly, she was brought up short by Pendergast, who had stopped and was looking over his shoulder.
Vincent? He asked.
Margot turned. DaGosta was standing behind them in the center of the vault, the air tanks and mask still in a pile by his feet.
You go on ahead, he said.
Pendergast looked inquiringly at him.
Can't swim, DaGosta explained simply.
Margot heard Snow curse fervently under his breath. For a moment, nobody moved. Then Smithback stepped back toward the lieutenant.
I'll help you out, he said. You can follow me. I told you I grew up in Queens. I don't know how to swim, DaGosta snapped. I'll sink like a damn stone.
Not with all that blubber you want, Smithback said, snatching a tank off the ground and placing it on DaGosta's back.
Just hold on to me. I'll swim for both of us if need be. You kept your head above water back in the sub-basement, remember? Just do what I do and you'll be okay.
He thrust the mask into DaGosta's hands, then pushed him ahead toward the group. At the far end of the chamber, an underground river ran off into darkness. Margot watched as first Snow, then Pendergast adjusted their masks and eased themselves into the dark liquid. Pulling her mask down over her eyes and placing the regulator in her mouth, she slid in after them. The air of the tanks was a welcome relief after the foul atmosphere of the tunnel. Behind her, she could hear a loud splashing as DaGosta half swam, half floundered through the viscous, lukewarm liquid, Smithback urging him on. Margot swam as quickly as she could through the tunnel, following the flickering light of Snow's headlamp, expecting at any moment to feel the massive concussion of the seal charges bring the ancient stone ceiling down behind them. Ahead, Pendergast and Snow had stopped, and she pulled up beside them.
We go down here, Snow said, popping the regulator from his mouth and pointing downward. Be careful not to scratch yourself, and for God's sake, don't swallow anything. There's an old iron pipe at the base of the tunnel here that leads...
At that moment, they felt, rather than heard, a vibration begin over their heads, a low, rhythmic rumbling that grew to a terrible intensity.
What's that? Smithback gasped, coming up with DaGosta. The charges?
No, Pendergast whispered.
Listen. It's one continuous stream of sound. It must be the dumping of the reservoir, prematurely.
They hung there in the foul liquid, mesmerized despite the danger by the long rolling sound of millions of gallons of water roaring down the ancient network of pipes that crossed and recrossed above their heads, heading directly for them.
30 seconds until the rest of the charges go, Pendergast said quietly, checking his watch.
Margot waited, trying to steady her breathing. She knew that if the charges failed, they'd be dead within minutes. The tunnel began to vibrate violently, the surface of the water jiggling and dancing. Small pieces of masonry and cement began to rain down into the water around them. Snow tightened his mask and took a last look around, then sank beneath the surface. Smithback followed, pushing the protesting DaGosta before him. Pendergast motioned Margot to go next. She sank into the darkness, trying to follow the faint light of Snow's headlamp as it descended into a narrow, rust-coated pipe. She could see the ungainly thrashing of DaGosta subside into more regular movements as he became used to breathing tank air. The tunnel leveled out, then snaked around two bends. Margot took a quick look behind to reassure herself that Pendergast was following. In the dim light of the swirling orange effluent, she could see the FBI agent motion her forward. Now she could see the group pausing at a junction ahead of her. The ancient iron pipe ended, and a gleaming steel tube continued onward. Beneath her feet, at the point where the two tunnels met, Margot could see a narrow tube leading downward. Snow gestured ahead, then pointed upwards with his finger, indicating that the vent riser to the west side lateral was directly ahead. Suddenly, there was a roar from behind them, an ominous, deep, rolling sound, horribly magnified in the tight, water-filled space. Then a sharp concussion sounded, and another, following one upon the other in rapid succession. Beneath the wildly flickering beam of his headlamp, Margot could see Snow's eyes widen. The final set of charges had gone off barely in time, crushing the spillways from the Devil's Attic, sealing it forever. As Snow frantically signaled them toward the riser, Margot felt a sudden tug at her legs, as if a tidal undertow were pulling her back toward the rally point. The feeling stopped as quickly as it had begun, and the water around her seemed to grow strangely dense. For a split second, she had the strange sensation of hanging motionless, suspended in the eye of a hurricane. Then, an enormous blast of overpressure boiled up from the iron pipe behind them, a roiling cyclone of muddy water that caused the tunnel itself to jerk and dance spasmodically. Margot felt herself battered against its iron flanks. Her mouthpiece came loose, and she reached for it frantically, hands grabbing through the storm of bubbles and thrashing sediment that surrounded her. There was another burst of pressure, and she felt herself forced downward, sucked into the pipe beneath her feet. She righted herself desperately and fought to swim back up to the junction, but a horrible suction only pulled her deeper into unguessable depths. The roaring sound continued, like the rushing of blood in her ears. She felt herself being knocked from side to side against the walls of the pipe, a piece of flotsam in the flood. Far above her head now, she could see, through the dim illumination of Snow's headlamp, Pendergast staring at her, his hand reaching down, tiny as a doll's, from what seemed countless miles away. Then there was another blast. The narrow tunnel collapsed above her head with a shriek of protesting metal, and as the endless rumbling continued, she felt herself falling ever farther into a watery darkness. 63. Hayward jogged through the mall toward the Banshell and Cherry Hill, Officer Carlin by her side. For all his bulk, he ran easily, with the grace of a natural athlete, didn't even break a sweat. The encounter with the moles, the tear gas, even the chaos they'd found when they regained the street, hadn't fazed him. Here, in the darkness of the park, the noise that had seemed so distant before was now much louder. A strange, ululating cry, continuously rising and falling, possessing a life of its own. Odd flickers and gouts of flame arose, blushing the underside of the ragged clouds overhead with patches of bright crimson.
"Jesus," Carlin said as he jogged. "It sounds like a million people all trying to murder each other."
"Maybe that's what it is," Hayward replied as she watched a troop of National Guardsmen double-timing northward ahead of them. They trotted over Bow Bridge and skirted the ramble, approaching the rear line of the police defenses. A long, unbroken string of news vehicles was parked along the transverse, engines idling. Overhead, a fat-bellied helicopter glided, its huge prop smacking the air as it moved at treetop level. A row of policemen had formed a ring around the castle terrace, and a lieutenant waved her through. With Carlin in tow, she crossed the terrace, then moved up the steps toward the castle ramparts. There, amidst a milling throng of police brass, city officials, National Guardsmen, and nervous-looking men speaking into portable telephones, was Chief Horlocker, looking about 10 years older than when Hayward had seen him barely 4 hours before. He was speaking with a slight, well-dressed woman in her late 50s, or rather, he was listening as the woman spoke in clipped, decisive sentences. Hayward moved closer and recognized the woman as the leader of Take Back Our City, the mother of Pamela Wisher.
"Atrocity unlike anything ever seen in this city before," Mrs. Wisher was saying. "A dozen of my personal friends are lying in hospital beds as we speak, and who knows how many hundreds more from among our ranks have been wounded. I promise you, and I promise the mayor, that lawsuits are going to fall like rain on this city, like rain, Chief Horlocker."
Horlocker made a valiant attempt.
Mrs. Wisher, our reports indicate that it was the younger element among your own marchers that incited this rioting.
But Mrs. Wisher was not listening.
And when this is all over, she continued, and the park and the streets are scrubbed free of the filth and ruin that litter them now, our organization will be stronger than ever. If the mayor feared us before tonight, he will fear us 10 times more tomorrow. The death of my daughter was the spark that set our cause on fire, but this outrageous assault on our liberties and our persons has set it ablaze. And don't think that—
Hayward backed off, deciding this was perhaps not the best time to approach the chief. She felt a tugging at her sleeve and turned to find Carlin looking at her. Wordlessly, he pointed over the esplanade toward the great lawn. Hayward glanced over, then froze, stupefied. In the close summer darkness, the great lawn had become a plain of fire. Several dozen groups of people were clashing, withdrawing, attacking, retreating, in a scene of pandemonium. The flickering light of numerous small fires in the trash cans that dotted the outskirts showed that the lawn, once a beautiful carpet of grass, had become a sea of dirt. The combination of darkness and dirt made it impossible to determine which of the rioters were homeless and which were not. To the west and east, double lines of police vehicles had positioned themselves, headlights pointed in toward the scene. In one corner, a large group of well-dressed marchers, take back our city's last remaining elite remnants, were retreating behind the police barricades, apparently realizing that the midnight vigil could not possibly take place. Squads of police and National Guardsmen were moving forward slowly from the periphery, breaking up fistfights, wielding batons, making arrests.
Shit! Hayward breathed with fervent conviction. What a balls-up!
Carlin turned toward her in surprise, then coughed disapprovingly into his hand. There was a sudden flurry of movement behind them, and Hayward turned to see Mrs. Wisher moving gracefully away, head held high, leading a small knot of retainers and bodyguards. In her wake, Horlocker looked like a fighter who'd finished a bad 12 rounds. He leaned against the sand-colored stone of the castle wall as if seeking its support.
"Have they finished dosing the reservoir with, well, whatever it's called?" he asked at last, fetching a ragged breath.
"Dioxin," said a well-dressed man standing by a battery-powered radio. "Yes, they finished 15 minutes ago."
Horlocker looked around with sunken eyes.
"Why the hell haven't we heard anything?"
His eyes landed on Hayward.
"You there!" he barked. "What's your name, Harris?"
Hayward stepped forward.
"It's Hayward, sir."
"Whatever."
Horlock pushed himself away from the wall.
"Heard anything from the Ghosta?"
"No, sir."
"Captain Waxy?"
"No, sir."
Abruptly, Horlocker sank back again. "Jesus Christ!" he muttered. Then he looked at his watch. 10 minutes to midnight. He turned to an officer at his right.
"Why the hell are they still at it?"
he said, pointing out toward the great lawn.
"When we try to round them up, they just break and reform somewhere else, and more seem to be joining, leaking through the perimeter at the south end of the park. It's hard without tear gas."
"Well, why the hell don't you use it, then?"
Horlocker demanded.
"Your orders, sir."
"My order? Wisher's people are gone now, you idiot! Gas them! Now!"
"Yes, sir."
There was a deep, booming sound, strangely muffled, seemingly from the center of the earth itself. Suddenly, life returned once again to Horlocker's limbs. He sprang forward.
"Hear that?"
he demanded.
"Those were the charges, the goddamn charges!"
A scattering of applause rang out from the cops manning the various communications devices. Carlin turned toward Hayward, a puzzled look on his face.
"Charges?"
he asked. Hayward shrugged.
"Beats me. What are they so happy about, with all hell breaking loose down there?"
As if on an unspoken signal, they both turned back toward the great lawn. The spectacle below was perversely fascinating. Cries and shouts rushed up toward them, a sonic wave almost physical in its force. Every few moments a single sound would separate itself from the roar, a curse, a scream, a smack of fist on flesh. Suddenly, from beyond the great lawn, Hayward heard a strange sighing sound, as if the very foundation of Manhattan had decided to give way. At first, she was unable to pinpoint its location. Then she noticed that the surface of the Central Park Reservoir, normally as calm as a mill pond, was suddenly in motion. Little wavelets broke the surface like whitecaps, and a series of bubbles began to roil its center. A silence fell in the command center as all eyes turned to the reservoir.
"Breakers," Carlin whispered. "In the Central Park Reservoir, I'll be goddamned."
There was a deep-throated belching sound, followed by the awesome rumbling of millions of cubic feet of water pouring with incredible force into underground Manhattan. On the plain of the Great Lawn, out of sight of the reservoir, the rioting continued. But beneath the sounds of conflict, Hayward heard, or rather felt, a great hollow rushing as of vast underground galleries and long-forgotten tunnels filling with the onslaught of water.
"It's too early!" Horlocker cried.
As Hayward watched, the surface of the reservoir began visibly dropping, first slowly, then more rapidly. In the reflected glow of the spotlights and the innumerable fires, she could see the exposed crescent of reservoir wall, its banks boiling and frothing from the force of a great central whirlpool.
"Stop,"
Horlocker whispered. The level continued to drop inexorably.
"Please, stop,"
Horlocker whispered, staring fixedly northward. The reservoir was draining faster now, and Hayward could see the surface of the water surging downward by the moment, exposing more and more of the cracked far wall abutting the east meadow and the ball field. Suddenly, the rumbling sound seemed to falter, and the turbulence lessened. The water grew calmer, slowing in its rapid descent. The silence in the command center was absolute. Hayward stared as a narrow band of bubbles flowed into the reservoir from its northward end. First a fine jet, then more and more until it had expanded into a heavy roar.
"Son of a bitch," Horlocker whispered. "They did it."
With the exits below sealed off, the reservoir ceased draining. However, water continued to pour into the reservoir from the upstate aquifers. With great sizzles and pops, the level of the water began to rise again. The churning at the northward end of the reservoir grew until the entire mass of water seemed to tremble from some kind of subterranean pressure. With the steady surge of thunder, the water rose and rose until at last it trembled on the edge of the embankment. Then, suddenly, it crested.
"Jesus," Carlin said. "I guess they're going swimming."
A massive flood of water spilled over the top of the reservoir and hurried away into the lambent darkness of the park, drowning the sound of fighting with its splashing, hissing, tumbling roar. Frozen in place, staring at the awe-inspiring sight, Hayward was reminded of a vast bathtub that had been allowed to overflow. She watched as the onrush of water leveled mounds of earth and worried away the ground among small trees and copses. It was like a huge river, she thought, gentle, shallow, but irresistible. And there was no mistake about where it was headed, the low ground of the Great Lawn. There was a moment of unbearable suspense as the onrushing water was hidden from the rioting plain that stretched beneath the castle ramparts. Then it appeared between the trees at the northern end of the lawn, a glistening swath of black, churning sticks and weeds and garbage before it. As it struck the edges of the crowd, Hayward could hear the noise of the fighting shift in tone and volume. A sudden uncertainty rippled through the rioters. Hayward watched as knots of people dispersed, reformed, dispersed again. Then the water was rushing over the length of the Great Lawn, and the shrieking mob was breaking for the high ground of the trees, slipping and stumbling over each other as they struggled toward the park exits and safety. And still the water advanced, licking around the baseball diamonds, swallowing up countless fires, knocking over trash cans. It swept into the Delacorte Theater with an immense gurgling sound, surrounded and then swallowed up Turtle Pond, and swirled around the base of Belvedere Castle itself, breaking against the stones and dark rivulets of foam. Then at last, the sound of rushing water began to die away. As the newly made lake grew still, bright points of reflected light appeared on its surface, more and still more as the water grew quieter, looking at last like a vast mirror of stars. For another long moment, the entire command center remained still, awed by the spectacle. Then, a spontaneous cheering burst out, filling the chambers and turrets of the castle and swirling upwards into the crisp summer night air.
"I wish my old daddy could have seen that,"
Hayward said over the noise, turning to Carlin with a grin.
"He would have said it was just like water in a dogfight. I'll bet money he would."
64. The early morning sun snuck in low over the Atlantic, kissing the sandy fork of Long Island, gliding over coves and harbors, villages and resorts, bringing a cool summer sweat to asphalt and pavement. Farther west, the brilliant arc illuminated the nearest reaches of New York City, briefly turning the gray welter of buildings a pale shade of rose. Following the ecliptic, the rays hit the East River, then burnished the windows of 10,000 buildings to a temporary sparkle, as if washing the city new in heat and light. Beneath the thick tangles of railroad track and overhead wire that crossed the narrow canal known as the Humboldt Kill, no light penetrated. The tenements that reared up, vacant and gray as vast dead teeth, were too numerous and too tall. At their feet, the water lay still and thick, its only currents formed by the rumble of the subway trains passing infrequently on the rail bridge above. As the sun followed its inexorable course west, a single beam of light slanted down through the labyrinth of wood and steel, blood red against the rusted iron, as sudden and sharp as a knife wound. It winked out again as quickly as it had arrived, but not before illuminating a strange sight, a figure, muddy and battered, curled motionless upon a thin revetment of brick that jutted mere inches above the dark water. Darkness and silence returned, and the foul canal was left to itself once again. Then its sleep was disturbed a second time. A low rumble sounded in the distance, approached in the dim gray dawn, passed overhead, receded, then returned. And beneath this rumble followed another, deeper, more immediate. The surface of the canal began to shake and quiver, as if jostled reluctantly to life. In the bow of the Coast Guard cutter, D'Agosta stood, stiff and vigilant as a sentry.
"There she is!"
he cried, pointing to a dark figure lying on the embankment. He turned to the pilot.
"Get those choppers the hell away! They're stirring the stink up off the water. Besides, we might need to get a medevac in here."
The pilot glanced up at the craggy, burnt-out facades and the steel bridges overhead, a look of doubt crossing his face, but he said nothing. Smithback crowded to the rail, straining to see in the lightening gloom.
"What is this place?"
he asked, tugging his shirt up over his nose. "Humboldt Kill," D'Agosta replied curtly. He turned to the pilot. "Bring us in closer, let the doctor get a look at her." Smithback straightened up and glanced over at D'Agosta. He knew the lieutenant was wearing a brown suit. He always wore brown suits. But the color was now completely undetectable beneath a damp mantle of mud, dust, blood, and oil. The gash above his eye was a ragged red line. Smithback watched the lieutenant give his face a savage wipe with his sleeve.
"God, let her be okay," D'Agosta
muttered to himself. The boat eased up to the revetment, the pilot backing the throttle into neutral. In a flash, D'Agosta and the doctor were over the side and onto the revetment, bending low over the prone figure. Pendergast stood in the shadows aft, silent, an intense look on his pale face. Margot suddenly jerked awake and blinked around at her surroundings. She tried to sit up, then clapped a hand to her head with a groan.
"Margot," D'Agosta said, "it's Lieutenant D'Agosta."
"Don't move," the doctor said, gently feeling her neck. Ignoring him, Margot pushed herself into a sitting position.
"What the hell took you guys?"
she asked, then broke into a series of racking coughs. "Anything broken?" the doctor asked.
"Everything," she replied, wincing. "Actually, my left leg, I think."
The doctor moved his attentions to her leg, slicing off her muddy jeans with an expert hand. He quickly examined the rest of her body, then said something to D'Agosta.
"She's okay," D'Agosta called up. "Have the medevac meet us at the dock."
"So?" Margot prompted. "Where were you?"
"We got sidetracked,"
Pendergast said, now at the side.
"One of your flippers was found in a settling tank at the treatment plant, badly chewed up. We were afraid that..."
He paused.
"Well, it was a while before we decided to check all the secondary exit points of the West Side Lateral." "Is anything broken?"
Smithback called down.
"Might be a small green splint fracture," the doctor said. "Let's get the stretcher lowered."
Margot sat forward.
"I think I can manage the..."
"You listen to the doc,"
D'Agosta said, frowning paternally. As the cutter rode the water next to the dank brickwork, Smithback and the pilot lowered the stretcher over the side, then Smithback jumped down to help Margot onto the narrow canvas. It took the three of them to lift her back over the side. D'Agosta followed Smithback and the doctor back on board, then nodded to the pilot.
"Get us the hell out of here."
There was a rumble of the diesel engine, and the boat backed off the revetment and surged into the canal. Margot leaned back carefully, resting her head on a flotation pillow as Smithback dabbed her face and hands clean with a damp towel.
Feels good,
she whispered. 10 minutes and we'll have you on dry land, Pendergast said, taking a seat next to her. 10 more and we'll have you in a hospital bed. Margot opened her mouth to protest, but Pendergast's look silenced her. Our friend, Officer Snow, told us about some of the things that grow in the Humboldt Kill, he said. Believe me, it'll be for the best.
What happened?
Margot said, closing her eyes and feeling the reassuring vibration of the boat's engines.
That depends, Pendergast answered. What do you remember?
I remember being separated, Margot said. The explosion?
The explosion knocked you into a drainage tunnel, Pendergast said. With Snow's help, we made it up the riser and eventually into the Hudson. You must have been sucked into the lateral sluice that drains into the Humboldt Kill.
Seems you followed the same path those two corpses took when the storm washed them out, DeGosta said.
Margot seemed to doze for a moment, then her lips moved again.
Frock!
Pendergast immediately touched his fingertips to her lips.
Later,
he said.
There'll be plenty of time for that, later.
Margot shook her head.
How could he have done it? She murmured. How could he have taken that drug, built that terrible hut?
She stopped.
It's unsettling to learn just how little you really know about even your closest friends, Pendergast replied. Who can say what secret desires fuel the inner flames that keep them alive? We could never have known just how much Frock missed the use of his legs. That he was arrogant was always obvious. All great scientists are arrogant to a point. He must have seen how Kawakita had already perfected the drug through many stages. After all, the drug that Kawakita took himself was obviously a later strain than that which created the wrinklers. Frock must have been supremely self-confident in his ability to correct that which Kawakita had overlooked. He saw the drug's potential to correct physical flaws, and he pushed that potential to its limit. But the final iteration of the drug warped the mind far more than it mended the body, and his deepest desires, his most secret lusts, were thus brought to the fore, magnified, perverted, and allowed to govern his actions. The hut itself is the ultimate example of this corruption. He wanted to be God, his God, the God of evolution.
Margot winced, then took a deep breath, dropping her hands to her sides and allowing the rocking of the boat to carry her thoughts far away. They moved out of the cloaca, through the Spuytendibbel, and into the fresh air of the Hudson. Already the pale light of dawn was giving way to a warm, late summer day. DeGosta stared off silently into the creamy wake of the cutter. Smithback sat on the railing, looking at Margot and chewing his nails. Idly, Margot realized that her right hand was lying over a bulge in her pocket. She reached in and pulled out the waterlogged envelope that Mephisto had given her in the black tunnel not so many hours before. Curiously, she opened it. A brief note lay inside, but whatever message it had contained was now washed into faint swirls and stains of ink. Enclosed by the note was a damp, black-and-white photograph, faded and heavily creased. It showed a young boy in a dusty front yard, wearing coveralls and a pint-sized version of a train engineer's cap, riding a wooden horse with wheels. The chubby face was smiling at the camera. In the background was an old house trailer, framed by cacti. Behind the trailer was a mountain range, low and distant. Margot stared for a moment, seeing in the happy little face the ghost of the man he would become. She carefully replaced the photograph and envelope in her pocket.
"What about the reservoir?"
she asked Pendergast in a quiet voice.
"The level hasn't fluctuated in the last 6 hours," Pendergast replied. "Apparently the water has been contained."
"So we did it," she said.
Pendergast did not reply.
"Didn't we?"
she asked, her eyes suddenly sharp. Pendergast looked away.
"It would seem so," he said at last. "Then what is it?"
she prodded.
"You're not sure, are you?"
He turned back to her, his pale eyes staring at her tousled face.
"With luck, the collapsed tunnels held and there was no leakage. In another 20 hours or so, the thioxin will have destroyed the plants remaining in the reservoir and in the tunnels below. But none of us can be sure. Not yet."
"Then how will we ever know?" Margot asked.
DeGosta grinned.
"Tell you what. 1 year from today, I'm going to head down to Mercer's on South Street and have one of those 2-pound swordfish steaks, nice and rare. And if I don't catch a good buzz,
Then maybe we can all breathe easier. Just then, the sun broke over Washington Heights, turning the dark water to the color of beaten electrum. Smithback, looking up from patting Margot's face dry, gazed at the scene. The tall buildings of Midtown flashing purple and gold in the morning light, the George Washington Bridge swept with silver light.
"As for myself," Pendergast said slowly, "I think I, too, will avoid Frutti del Mare for the foreseeable future."
Margot looked at him quickly, trying to read the joke in his expression, but his gaze remained steady, and eventually she simply nodded her understanding. And last. No additional Take Back Our City rallies ever took place. Mrs. Wisher was given an honorary post in the city government as community liaison, and when a new administration was elected the following year, worked closely with it to increase civic awareness. A vest pocket park on East 53rd Street was dedicated to the memory of Pamela Wisher. Laura Hayward turned down an offered promotion, electing instead to leave the department and complete her graduate studies at New York University. Bill Smithback's first-hand account of the events of that night went on to spend several months on the hardcover bestseller lists, despite heavy pre-publication editing by government officials under the direction of Special Agent Pendergast. In the end, Margot persuaded Smithback, bullied might be a better word, into donating half of his earnings to various homeless missions and charity foundations. 1 year to the day after the flooding of the Astor Tunnels, Pendergast, DaGosta, and Margot Green met for lunch at a famous seafood restaurant near the South Street Seaport. Although their conversation remains their own, when they left the restaurant, DaGosta was sporting a large and apparently relieved grin. Author's note. While the events and characters portrayed in this novel are fictitious, much of the background and underground setting of the novel is not. Large numbers of underground homeless, sometimes known as tunnel people or mole people, live in the subterranean spaces of Manhattan, including the warren of tracks, tunnels, rooms, pipes, and abandoned stations underneath Grand Central, Penn Station, and throughout the city. Grand Central Station alone has numerous subterranean levels where human beings have lived, raised children, and died. The Astor Tunnels, with their elegant stations crumbling into dust, actually exist on a smaller scale and under a different name. No comprehensive maps exist of these vast underground warrens. It is truly unexplored and at times very dangerous territory. The authors are indebted to the book Mole People by Jennifer Toff, which is an excellent source of information on underground Manhattan. We also wish to thank Akra Shep for helping shed some light on this subterra incognita.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Reliquary by Douglas Preston. Copyright 1997, Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Read by Dick Hill. Directed by Ruth Bloomquist. Engineered by Kim King. Performance copyright 1997, Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved.
For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.